echoing hip-hop that made one feel sort of sexy and important, and she was telling endless stories about bad behavior by musicians I hadn't heard of, but that made Natalie and Penny howl. Then he zipped up. And by zipped up, I mean the back of his unicorn costume. It was incredible. I didn't really understand this story, but I could tell Jessa was telling it well.
And was that how you guys met?
Natalie was giggling.
At a show like that?
No, Charlotte and I go way back, Jessa said. Rehab. The girls shot each other a look. Penny had her own Disney Channel sitcom. Natalie was a Lifetime movie veteran turned Christian recording artist. If Jessa and I were drug addicts and this night of ours went public, their public image would suffer. Eating disorder, I said, to make myself seem like a safer prospect. It wasn't exactly a lie. Still, I hated the implication that that was intrinsically better than the addiction, or less my fault. I don't really want to talk about it. I'm doing better now. Penny relaxed completely.
Oh, you guys, she said, and it was genuine. I'm so sorry.
But Natalie looked more troubled, a sort of troubled I was familiar with, and that, put together with the state of her right index finger, gave me more information for the file I was building on her in my head. My phone chirped. I looked at it under the table. It was from my source at Sheringford. Things are getting worse for him, it read. How soon can you come to Connecticut? I realized, dispassionately, that I would rather be nearly anywhere else, even my old boarding school. But it was the final hand of the night, and I was closing in on my kill. The river, Jessa said, while Penny dealt. The game was Texas Hold'em.
And it turns! Final bets, ladies!
Penny raised, but she was bluffing. She was tapping her foot under the table, the way she had the last three times. Natalie had better cards than Jessa did, to be sure. She had a way of too nonchalantly eating fries when she was sure she was going to win. But I had better cards than Jessa, too, who was big blind. Since she had to put money down, she'd stayed in. And anyway, she'd split her winnings with me at the end of the night. My phone sounded again in my pocket. It would be poor manners for me to duck out now. But I looked, despite myself. Jamie needs you, it said. It's only going to get worse. I gripped my phone under the table. I needed to win this round rather desperately. Natalie studied her cards.
Charlotte Holmes, she mused. That's so funny. I've been thinking about this all night. You know, I loved the Sherlock Holmes stories when I was a kid.
People like to add that tag, when I was a kid, as though there was something childish about them.
That's great, I said.
Because while I didn't particularly want to hand her secrets over to Jessa, I also didn't care about her, or what she had or hadn't read. I only wanted her to bet, so I could leave and contact my source in private. I tried not to think about the implications of that last text. Watson, dead, on his dorm room floor. Watson dead, shot in the snow, like,
you know, I met a Moriarty recently.
My pulse quickened. No one noticed, of course, except for me, as I have a very good poker face.
It's a common Irish last name, I told Natalie. You meet a lot of them. No, she said, and she tapped her cards against the table. Like a real storybook Moriarty. I go to the Virtuoso School, you know, for working young actors and singers or whatever, and he was getting a tour. They had him sit in on my songwriting class. I guess he'd invested some money in the program.
Lucy and Moriarty's consulting firm's client list. The new additions, a large, posh hospital in D.C., a wilderness rehabilitation facility for teenagers in Connecticut, and a Manhattan prep school for the arts.
You got a bet, lady, Jessa said, sensing the turn in the conversation. Then we can order up more champagne. Maybe I can call DJ Pocket Watch, see if she wants to come over.
My phone chirped again.
Did you ask him if he'd committed any crimes recently?
I asked lightly, but with just enough edge to let Natalie know I was bothered. It was a tone that drew people in, made them want to know the story behind your upset. It rarely failed. It didn't now. She leaned in, fascinated.
Whoa, do you guys still have run-ins?
I shrugged. Of a sort.
What was he like? Not very interesting. He had on a slouchy hat like he thought he was cool, big glasses. He liked the song I played. "Are there a lot of people in your songwriting class?" I asked. "I mean, anyone I've heard of?" Natalie snuck a peek at her cards. "Not unless you follow folk rock. I mean, Annie Henry is a big deal fiddler. Penn Olson and Maggie Hartwell have been playing together for a while. Come on, guys," Penny said. The music had stopped, and she was staring at all of her money piled up in the middle of the table. "Can we, like, get this over with?" I pulled my chips toward me, and I found I didn't care about my winnings. Maggie Hartwell. Michael Hartwell was one of Lucien's fake identities. My phone chirped. "You know you can stop this before it happens," it read. And just like that, I was elsewhere. Gone. August's eyes taking me apart on the plane back to England. August ducking his head into my room in Greystone, my violin in his hand. "Will you play for me?" August in the snow. Things I could have stopped before they happened. I could get on the train, tonight. I could be at Penn Station in an hour. "You need to feel it," D.I. Green had said. "Or else, every now and then, it'll happen anyway, and you'll continue to do very stupid things." I forced myself to breathe. Jessa and I had played together enough at this point that she could read me across the table. A distant part of me thought it was a pity she and I weren't bridge partners. "Penn Olson and Maggie Hartwell?" she asked, picking up my slack. "Are they on YouTube?" Natalie laughed. "I guess. They're not big or anything. They do covers, mostly. Maggie's a sweetie, but Penn has a really big head." "Breathe." I was breathing. "Huh," I said, and it didn't sound strained. "She has nothing on you, girl," Jessa said to Natalie. "Have you heard Natalie's new single, Penny? It's so effing good." "It is so good." Penny kissed Natalie's head. "You need to talk to the producers of my show. Maybe we can write you into an episode. I think we're doing a musical one soon." They were looking at each other, so they didn't see the flash of jealousy in Jess's eyes. We sorted the money quickly, changing out the chips for cash. The champagne had run out. "God, I'm tired, and now I'm super broke," Penny said, packing up her bag. "And I have call at 7 tomorrow morning. We're shooting a pool scene first thing. Maybe I shouldn't have eaten those chicken tenders. Oof. Love you, love you." She kissed her hands and blew at us. "But let's not do this again till I get paid, okay?" Girls could be so profligate with their love, as though by spreading it wide they would induce the world to love them back, as though the world wasn't going to take that love and beat them with it. Still, I blew a kiss at Penny. I waved goodbye to Natalie. I checked my winnings carefully, nearly $3,000, I had taken almost the whole pot, and then faced Jessa across her notebook. In that moment, I worried that I would open my mouth, that it would all come pouring out, how horribly I had behaved, and for how long, how much damage I had done, as though I would confess to the first person who asked. Jessa saved me from myself. "That was useful for you." When alone with me, her way of speaking had begun to mirror my own. She was clipped, precise, hoarser. It was clear that she was taking a new acting class, and that I was the current object of her study. At that moment, I couldn't imagine why anyone would want to pretend to be me. "Imagine your father is sitting across that table," I told myself. "Be bloodless." And just like that, I was again. The information about the Virtuoso School, yes, it was useful to me. "Did you learn anything about them, Penny and Natalie?" In fact, I had learned quite a bit. I opened my mouth, then hesitated. "Is it too much for me to ask how you plan to use this information?" "I imagine the way you use money, as currency." She waited for effect, then blinked her blue eyes rapidly. I wondered if I did that too, before launching into an explanation. "These girls are my competition. A rumor can be useful, knowing their flaws, their foibles. I hoard the best ones, though, and if I'm short on money, I sell those secrets to TMZ. We regarded each other. To be honest, her imitation of me was unsettling enough that I was having trouble thinking. Was this what I seemed like to strangers? I put that idea on to simmer, while I told Jessa what I'd learned, that Natalie believed in God and prayed silently when she felt she was losing at cards. Her faith was personal enough that she kept a small cross necklace not around her neck, but in her pocket, where her hand returned to it like a worry stone. Penny had an older sister she worshipped. It was clear that the boots she was wearing had a previous owner, and they were, one, half a size too big, two, made too recently to be vintage, three, 5 years out of fashion. The sister had worn the boots for something practical, perhaps horseback riding. The sole was worn in the place where something like a stirrup would go, but Penny wore them for love. Perhaps the sister was dead. I couldn't tell from the data at hand. "That's it," Jessa said when I'd finished. She was frustrated enough to revert back to being herself, much to my mixed disappointment and relief. "No habits or addictions or exes or..." Natalie was bulimic. Penny had a girlfriend back home she wanted no one to know about. Natalie, at some point in her life, had lost over 100 pounds and quickly. She had stretch marks, slight ones, when her crop top rode up over her pants. Penny wanted to quit the business after her contract was up, perhaps, this was a surmise, to spend more time with her beloved sister. Perhaps the sister was not dead, but dying, I needed more time to observe her. Neither of them ever wanted to play poker with us ever again. Jessa made her own money now, through royalties and residuals. She was not short on cash in any meaningful way, despite what her selling secrets to tabloids would suggest. At the very least, she didn't need me to ruin two girls' lives to keep herself away from her mother and her own ruined past. "No," I said to Jess's disgruntled face, "that's everything." And I knew I would never play poker with her again either. How much damage I had done. How much damage I would continue to do. On the street, I checked my phone again. My Sherringford source had written me one last message. "It's on your head," it said, as though that was a new thing. My heart rate had slowed. I wouldn't go to Penn Station tonight. I wouldn't head into Sherringford, guns blazing on some supposition. I would go home and force myself to feel things about my past for 30 minutes on a timer, and I would continue with my plan, as it was the best way to keep Jamie Watson safe. Safer than August had ever been. Safe from me. I lit a cigarette, the first I'd allowed myself in weeks. I had money, I had eaten food I hadn't had to pay for. It was late, and I was actually tired, and in the morning, I had an interview with Starway Airlines. I had quite a bit of prep to do.
13. Jamie. Detective Shepard had gone through Lena's phone while she stood there, arms crossed, rolling her eyes. "I thought you actually, like, wanted to make a call." He scrolled again through her texts, her missed and received call log, her contacts, and then he tossed her mobile back. Because she was Lena, she caught it neatly with one hand. "Just was a little too good to be true," he said. "You disappeared. Then immediately, Ms. Williamson got that phone call from the gallery with a confession."
"Serendipity," she said, and wound up her scarf. "It's an SAT word. Look, since it's a school night and everything, I should go home. Jamie, text me or something tomorrow, okay?"
She waved goodbye and left. Everyone else had left, too. My father was warming up the car in the parking lot. The detective zipped up his parka, looking out over the snowy quad.
"I'm not going to say it's good to see you again," he said.
I shivered. "I'm sorry," I said. "I don't really want to be in this mess either. I am happy, though, that you're working the case." I meant it. I'd always liked Detective Shepard. He was smart and determined and flexible enough to work with me in Holmes. I just wished I wasn't always the person he was investigating. He stuffed his hands in his pockets.
"You've made some real enemies, kid," he said. "Or she has. Charlotte. I don't know. I hope it's all been worth it. I'll call you in the morning. Don't leave town."
I told him I wouldn't, then got in my father's car.
"You didn't make that call?" I asked Lena.
She wrote back instantly.
"Told you I was useful. You don't need to be a dealer to keep a burner phone in your bag. He didn't ask me for that one. Ha ha. Night, Jamie. XOXO.
I laughed to myself. It was late. Late enough that we were the only car on the road back to his house out in the country. It had been where I'd grown up, out here, playing tag in the yard with my father, eating dinner outside together in the summer, my sister and I locking each other in the closet below the stairs. My father lived there now with my stepmother, Abigail, and my half-brothers, Malcolm and Robbie. They'd set aside a room for me, what had been the stuffy old guest room before. I hadn't decorated it, and I didn't sleep there much, but it was good to know it was there anyway. I kept enough clothes there, a razor, some shoes. I wouldn't have to go back to the dorm for my things. When we walked in the door, Abigail was waiting up for us in the living room. She'd had a fire going, but it had faded down to embers.
"Jamie," she said, and pulled me into a tight hug. "You're okay. Thank God. And you,"
my father said. "Hello to you, too."
"Will you tell me next time, instead of leaving me a note saying, 'Jay in trouble, be home late,' and then not answering any of my texts?"
"I'm sorry, things moved very fast." There wasn't a lot of apology in his apology. "Can we talk about this tomorrow? I don't want to wake up the kids."
"It's fine, they haven't seen you in days anyway."
Abigail tugged on her nightgown.
"Sorry, Jamie. I'm exhausted, and this... Anyway, go to bed. We'll figure it out."
"Your mom's coming in," he said to me. "I spoke to her earlier. She changed her tickets, she and Shelby. We'll figure out lodgings. Maybe you on the couch? We can talk more about it tomorrow."
"You talk to Grace tonight, and not me,"
Abigail said. I took that as my cue to go upstairs. They kept on quarreling quietly, the sound creeping up the stairs as I got myself ready for bed. My father wasn't an award-winning parent, to be sure, but I thought he'd grown out of some of his shittier habits. No matter how much I'd fantasized as a kid that he would give up Abigail and America and come back to us in London, it wasn't anything I wanted from him now. I'd wondered a little how he was keeping up with his work or the house or his two little kids, what with all the traipsing around with Leander, but my father was an adult, and as far as I knew, adults worked those things out. I guess my father hadn't. I fell into an uneasy sleep, and when I woke, it was late morning, the day half started already. A kettle was whistling downstairs, and the door to my room was open. In the kitchen, Abigail was nowhere to be found. Malcolm, my toddler brother, was missing too, and my father and Robbie, who was school-aged. Was it a school day? I was too tired to remember. In lieu of any members of my family, Leander was perched at the counter, scrolling through a news site on his tablet. His dress shirt was pressed, and he was freshly shaved.
"Good morning, troublemaker," he said.
"Please tell me that's not going to be my nickname." He'd switched off the whistling kettle, but the water was still hot. I made myself a cup of tea. "Though I guess I'm a wanted thief, and possible druggist if the dean has me pegged right."
"How much of it do you think is Lucian?"
Leander asked, setting down the tablet. "The paintings, for sure. My father filled you in on that?" At his nod, I said. I thought at first the phone call from the shop was Lucian toying with me, like showing how easily he could reach into my life and how he had the power to fix it, if he were inclined to. But it turned out to be Lena Gupta instead, getting me off the hook.
"I always liked that girl," he said.
"Yeah, Lena's great." I leaned back against the counter. "As for the rest of it, my dad doesn't know this, but the laptop sabotage? Someone emailed Elizabeth, pretending to be me, and asked her to be there for it. And for the party, too." Leander nodded.
"Do you want to walk me through it?"
"All of it?"
"I could help."
"And you won't tell my dad?" He hesitated.
"No, I'll let you do that.
Deal?" "Deal." He picked up his tablet again.
"Let's start with times, if you have them, and places, and where everyone was when it happened."
When I finished, he said, "My thoughts. We'll approach the problem from two separate sides. If you feel comfortable asking questions around your school, I'll keep on with my investigation in the city. I have an appointment today I'd like to keep." "Is my father coming?" I asked. Leander looked uncomfortable.
"He and Abigail are taking a day," he said. "It's important, especially with your family coming in, that the two of them have a moment alone to recalibrate."
"Oh,
I studied him for a moment, the man I'd come to think of as my own uncle. He had a careless sort of elegance that he wore like a cloak, and every now and then, if he let you get close enough, you saw how deliberately it had been woven, what he hid beneath it. Has this happened before? Leander hadn't ever been one to mince words with me.
With your mother quite a few times. Never before with Abigail. If this isn't settled soon, I'll go back to London and try to do my part from there. I might be putting some strain on the situation.
When I called up an image of my father in my head, he was cheerfully rumpled in his usual corduroy and blazer, and in that imagining, he was never alone. Leander Holmes was there beside him. Not my mother and not Abigail, but his best friend, one I'd only known in person now for a year. But I'd never really considered what a problem that would be for the woman my father was married to. When your life was split that way, how could you ever have everything? Maybe some of us weren't meant to. I thought like a reflex about Holmes, my Holmes, that night in the hotel in Prague, determined and afraid, and her arms around my neck, whispering words I couldn't hear, words she maybe thought I could read from the shape her lips made against my skin. And it wasn't something I ever let myself think about, much less in front of her uncle, who was like an actual reader of minds, or after I'd just been thinking about my father. And I flushed, and then flushed again when Leander gave me a startled look. God, he was deducing things. And then I hurried away as fast as I could to pour myself more hot water. Leander cleared his throat.
"Want a ride up to campus?"
he asked after a moment. His voice was very, very neutral. "Nope," I said, fanning the steam away from my face.
"Nope.
No, I can walk." It was a very long walk. In the end, Leander insisted, and I was back at Sherringford by noon.
14. Charlotte. Starway Airlines was one of the oldest in the business. They'd been one of the few not to go bankrupt in the early years of the new century, and they had responded by doubling down on their luxury offerings – leather seats, free checked bags, a steam room in the airport lounge, while the other airlines cut their costs. They specialized in long-haul flights, non-stop to Dubai and Melbourne and Kyoto, trips that took days and were expensive to begin with, and they decked out those planes with beds and masseuses. Which is to say, one couldn't look cheap for an interview to work as a Starway gate agent, not if one wanted to represent their brand. I slicked my hair back into a high bun and put on false eyelashes. I put on the skirt suit I pressed and prepared for the occasion. In short, I looked the part. There was pleasure in that. At the airport, I gave my credentials at the stairway information desk.
"The recruiter will come and walk you there in about 15 minutes, the kind-eyed clerk said.
I asked him the exact time and then where the toilets were, scrubbing out my accent into the Queen's English. For whatever reason, Americans love the English. The clerk smiled and pointed the way, and now I knew he would remember both me and exactly when we'd met. I had spent some time with the airport map these last few weeks. Starway had the smallest presence of any airline at this airport. Their desk was at the far end of the terminal, and there was no one in line for the kiosks or for an agent, not at 9 a.m. on a Wednesday for an airline that had so few commuter flights. I waited until the only agent on duty stepped off for a break, and then, in my skirt suit and pumps, I stepped behind the counter and up to their monitor. Thankfully, the agent had left himself signed in. I didn't have to try the clearance code I'd watched an agent enter at Heathrow. It had been the weak point in my plan, and I was relieved to dispense with it. Once in, I needed a moment to get myself oriented. The screen was black, with scrolling white text, and the only way to navigate was with keyboard shortcuts. It took several false starts before I even got myself into the right system. Above me, cheerful pop music was playing, and I tapped my foot along with it to steady myself. There. Future reservations. From the corner of my eye, I saw the desk agent approaching, hands in his pockets, looking out the giant windows at the end of the terminal. And then he focused his gaze on his destination. He saw me at the monitor, and he began to walk faster. I'd assumed this would happen. I'd styled my clothes as closely as I could to the existing Starway employees so that, from a distance, any employee would have a moment of doubt that would keep them from immediately calling in the police. I knew I had about 2 minutes. But I only had one hand to type with now, because with the other, I was pressing the desk phone up to my face and crying. Reservations. I ran Michael Hartwell, then Peter Morgan Vilk. Quickly, I put the names into the system, and the results began to scroll downward. I'd watched hours of tutorials online, but there were a number of keyboard shortcuts I hadn't quite mastered. When I pressed what I thought was the page down button, the screen went blank. I pressed it again, and the screen returned. Quickly, with my index finger, I punched in the three-key sequence to bring me back several pages, and I put the names back in again with that same finger, the phone against my face itself in tears, my body angled away from the screen to make it seem as though I was a harmless young professional girl who couldn't possibly be hacking into their system. The agent was talking into his radio. By the door, the security officer perked up and turned my way. Moments. I had moments. I needed a flight record, a complete one, and to know the next time Moriarty was arriving. Today was Wednesday, the day that Lucien always flew to New York from what I'd seen from my weeks at Heathrow in London.
"Hey,"
the agent said gruffly.
"Hey, you, what are you doing?"
I'd found it. Quickly, I hit the print key. The results tumbled out onto the carpeted floor. The agent was in sight of me now.
"Stop! Stop what you're doing!"
I gasped, dropped the phone, and crumpled to the floor. He rounded the desk to find the screen blank and me sobbing.
"What? Who are you? What are you doing? Young lady?"
"I'm having a panic attack," I said through the tears. "I have a Starway interview today. I had to call my doctor. I couldn't breathe. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Don't arrest me."
Crouching, he picked the phone up off the floor and put it to his ear. I could hear the cheerful message. "Press 8 if you need to make an appointment. Press 9 to hear these options again."
"You don't have a phone?"
he said, helping me to my feet. I smiled at him shakily.
"Not one that works in the States,"
I said, my accent posh and plummy.
"I'm just getting myself set up."
The agent's eyes went again to his monitor screen. It was blank. He relaxed infinitesimally. Let him think he'd signed himself off.
"This might not be the best job for you,"
he was saying, steering me back toward the information desk at the center of the terminal.
"It gets pretty stressful here."
"Does it? I bet it's awful around the holiday."
It was enough to get him telling a funny story, something about a girl in a reindeer suit, and when the bewildered clerk at the desk confirmed that I was in fact there for an interview, that I'd checked in 5 minutes ago, that he had spoken to me himself, the agent said,
"Listen, Charlotte, don't worry about it, but maybe don't take this job."
And before either of them had another thought about calling the police, I was outside and in a taxi en route to Manhattan. The driver raised an eyebrow at me when I fished a sheaf of papers out from under my skirt. I barely had the time to stuff them into my tights. I flipped through them slowly, trying to make some sense of what I was reading. Michael Hartwell wasn't flying to New York. Peter Morgan Vilk wasn't flying to New York. They weren't flying to Boston or D.C. Nothing confirmed, nothing in the reservation system. I checked it through again to be sure. That left the last page. The contingency search I had done at the last possible second. We bumped along in traffic, thick now as any London rush hour, and as the driver rode his brakes, I took a deep, steadying breath, then held the last page up to the light. There. Lucien Moriarty was flying to America, tonight, as Tracy Paulnitz. I had waited for this for the last year, and still I wasn't ready. I couldn't quite breathe. Why couldn't I breathe? I needed to speak to someone who knew me well, and from before all this, someone I could trust. Without even really thinking about it, without considering the repercussions, I picked up my mobile and called the only number I had thought to save.
15. Jamie. I'd arranged to meet Elizabeth over her lunch break. I called her, so she knew for sure this time that it was me. The parking lot was near the far end of the quad at the bottom of a slope, and I could see her walking toward me long before she arrived. The red flag of her blazer under her parka, her legs in tights, the scattering bright of her hair. She was beautiful and magnetic, and I was wasting her time. I knew it especially when she passed me a hot paper cup from the cafeteria. "Coco," she said, "I figured you wouldn't want anyone to see you in there since you're sort of suspended." "Thanks," I said, cupping it in my hands. "I don't think they have a watch out for me, but yeah, I'm trying to lay low." We looked at each other for a long minute. "You're not a good boyfriend," she said, like it was simple. Maybe it was. "Someone is playing on that, I think. They want me to be mad at you. I am, but for different reasons."
"I'm sorry," I said.
"I know."
"I thought that I could. I really like you. You're really cool and really pretty and..."
"I know," she said, a bit despairingly. "I think I am too. And I just have my head somewhere else. I'm graduating and last year was a mess and I know I haven't been good to you." I had this urge to reach out to touch her, but I didn't know what that would accomplish. "I don't know if it's because of that or if I'm just not a good guy."
Elizabeth shifted her weight from foot to foot.
"Just because you know something about yourself doesn't mean you should be forgiven for it."
"I'm sorry," I said again. It was over, then. It was for the best.
"So stop."
I'm sorry, what?
"Stop," she said again, louder. "If you know it, just stop. Stop. You like me. This shouldn't be this hard. I can't believe you're so hung up on someone you never even dated. Not really. Was she ever your girlfriend? She broke your heart anyway. Maybe that makes it worse. Do I need to break your heart? Is that how I can get in there under your skin?"
An hour ago, I'd been thinking about Holmes in my bed. Even the memory now made me feel claustrophobic, too hot. And whether it was the way love should feel, I didn't know.
"I don't know," I said aloud. "I don't want that to be true." "I'll help you clear all this up," she said. "This mess."
"What mess? The Moriarty mess?
Elizabeth, stop it with the pity voice," she crossed her arms.
"Why would you put yourself in that kind of danger? What would any of this prove?
That I'm a better person than she is?"
I took it like a knife to the gut. No matter how many times I'd thought it to myself, that Holmes was a garbage human, a real piece of work.
"Don't say that. It isn't true.
This isn't a contest of who's less of a fuck-up. I think I'd lose if it was."
"Stop," she said, shaking a little with the force of what she was saying. "I'll help you clear this up because it involves me, and I hear things around here that you don't, and God, Jamie, you need a little help, I think."
"It has to be over, though," I said. "Between us."
"Okay, fine. So we'll fix this, then we'll see."
I should have said no. I had Lena's help. I had my father and Leander. I had a 5-day, maybe, suspension lighting a fire under my ass. But Elizabeth was so adamant and so cracklingly smart, it felt wrong to refuse her help.
"Where do we start?"
We walked slowly back up the hill toward school.
"Anna's in the hospital. Word is that Lena put her there, what with the ratting her out for the MDMA.
Elizabeth's mouth twisted.
"No one's really sad about that. Anna's not a prize."
"I don't know her that well."
"She's Sherringford's swine," she said with a bitterness I didn't expect. "Lots of money. There are these amazing scholars who teach at this school, people who've written biographies of Elizabeth Bishop, who worked at the White House, who worked at NASA, and Anna doesn't take notes and pays her hallmates to write her essays. Money gets you a lot here, but $1,000 is a whole nother level."
"Did it exist in the first place? Like, did she bring it to the party?" Elizabeth gestured with her cup. We were approaching the student union.
"Let's go find out."
The union had a restaurant inside, the bistro, where for $10 you could have them make you a sandwich with the same ingredients they had in the cafeteria.
Students went in the evening if they'd had to miss dinner for sports or studying, and the faculty had lunch there if they hadn't packed their own. I hadn't heard of any students going during school hours. It seemed sort of pointless. But there they were, Anna's friends in pleated skirts and snow boots, eating their sandwiches next to the fireplace. Three of them had their hair up in high cheerleader ponytails, but the girl at the center had her long, red hair loose and wavy. They sat almost as if arranged. "They've been watching too many CW shows," Elizabeth said, and determinedly started forward. "Elizabeth," the redhead said placidly.
"Hi."
"Oh, hi, Jamie." I didn't know any of their names, but I guess I had just supposedly scammed their friend, so... "Hi," I said.
"Was the money real?"
Elizabeth asked. I blinked. I was used to Holmes maneuvering herself in with a suspect, building trust and planting bombs. She never went for the jugular this soon.
"No,"
the redhead said, and took another bite. There was some history between the two of them that I was missing.
"I don't remember you at poker night. Were you there?"
The redhead regarded me over her sandwich.
"I wasn't invited. I don't have an upperclassman boyfriend."
"We don't either," one of the girls said.
"You wish you did," the redhead retorted.
The other girls looked at each other. One shrugged. They went back to their conversation.
"Jamie's not a status symbol," Elizabeth said. "He's
something you wanted and went out and got.
I was there.
I was your friend before you dumped me."
"I'm sorry," I told her, backing away. "I sort of feel like I shouldn't be here."
"So, the money wasn't real," Elizabeth was saying.
"Did you put her up to it? Who did? Why was she there?"
One of her friends piped up.
"She wanted to be there. We all did. Kittredge was there."
"Kittredge?" I asked.
"Yeah,"
she said.
"He's gorgeous."
The redhead shrugged. "Don't go thinking it's all about you," she told me.
"It's not."
"No," I said, trying not to laugh. They were talking about a guy who had a farting contest with his roommate that you could hear all the way out in the hall. "It's all about Kittredge, I guess."
"And the money?"
"Look, honestly, I don't know. You'll have to ask Anna," the redhead said. "She spends a lot with Beckett Lexington and his stash. She spends a lot at Barney's online. Maybe she overspent and was embarrassed. She told Lainey and Aditi and Swetha that she was going to stake them, the other girls, if their expressions were any indication. And maybe she didn't realize she was too short on cash to do it. Got to the party, decided to blame you.
I don't know.
I think there's more to it than that."
"If anyone knows, it's Jason Kittredge," said Aditi.
"Lainey?"
"He was on her from the second she showed up. He'll know if she had it to begin with."
"Thanks." Elizabeth lingered there for a beat.
"Marta,"
she said to the redhead.
"Your hair looks really good."
"Thanks," Marta said. Her eyes didn't soften.
"I like your boots."
"Thanks." This strange ritual complete, we left. "What's the story there?" I asked, pushing the union door open.
"There isn't one," Elizabeth said. "They wanted things from me they couldn't have."
I stared at her, washed over with the strangest déjà vu.
"What?" "It's pretty simple. Undying loyalty."
She pulled out her phone.
"Which means no fuckboys. And everyone's a fuckboy. Crushes are fine, boyfriends aren't. Dinner with the group every night at 7. Those are the rules."
"Wait, they think I'm a fuckboy?"
"You have a fuckboy haircut," she informed me, rapid-fire texting someone. "And no, I've been dating you for too long for anyone to think that. You were famously in love with a junkie who'd dropped out of school. You'd been framed for murder together, and now she was gone, and they thought it was all crushingly romantic. Marta told me you'd break my heart, and we stopped being friends over it."
I didn't know what to say. "Why didn't you tell me?" Elizabeth put her phone away.
"Because I didn't want you to tell me it was true. I have to go to biology. I'll see you later."
She kissed me on the cheek and trotted up the hill. There was so much about this girl I still didn't know. 3 hours to kill until the end of the school day when I could corner Kittredge in his room. I ducked into the library and hurried quickly up into the stacks, to the PQ to PR section. It was silent. Most students didn't have a free period, and almost no one had it after lunch, and smelled overwhelmingly like old leaves. The heater, as usual, was working overtime. I shed my outer layers into a pile and sat down at a carrel. On the ride back to my father's last night, I'd finally changed my email password. I pulled the account back up to go through the sent messages again. The remarkable thing was that the fake emails sounded so much like me. Whoever had been forging my email had read through my old messages, listened to the tone, noted the way I'd signed off. The final one I'd sent yesterday to Elizabeth read, "E, I'm so sorry about before. Maybe it's best if we meet somewhere public and then we can go talk. Come to Tom's party. I'll be there. J. X." It was stupid to be unnerved by it. The template was literally right there in the hundreds of samples I'd sent just this school year. And still I was. The initials E, J were easy enough to copy, and the 1 or 2 X sign-off was standard practice for any email you sent in Britain. But the long, short sentence combo, the statement that ended in a question mark, the dash, they were all things I did all the time and hadn't realized until now. There wasn't any clue there, at least not that I could tell. Nothing to learn except this wasn't a slapdash job. They would have taken at least a few hours to learn how to convincingly sound like me. It had to be Lucian. Who else could it be? But I'd seen firsthand what you got from forming conclusions before you had the facts. You dragged in Moriartys, Milo Holmeses. You threw your weight around trying to make your guess right. You ended up with a friend shot dead in the snow. On my phone, a text popped up in my international app. I was grateful for the distraction. "I'll see you soon," Shelby said. "Checking out that school, then headed to Dad's house. Lots to tell. Hear you're in trouble again. Shocker." I sent her a line of vomit emojis and a "see you soon." I still had time to kill, so I did my best to begin a response paper for AP Euro on one of the school computers. It was hard to feel focused. If I was suspended for stealing in the spring of my senior year, it didn't matter what grades I got. I wouldn't be going to college anywhere. I felt a weird sort of calm about it. Maybe it was fatalism. Maybe it didn't matter if it was. I was good at writing papers. Not amazing, but good enough. And we had been reading about the causes of the First World War, and I found myself getting into the rhythm of it, laying down sentences, rearranging them, contradicting myself, and then stopping to figure out what I actually thought. I was so engrossed that I didn't notice Kittredge was sitting next to me until he leaned in and breathed, hot and disgusting, into my ear. "You were looking for me? Because I have a lot to say to you."
16. Charlotte. I had made the call. I was waiting for a response. I was receiving 3 text messages a minute from my Sheringford source saying, "Why aren't you responding? Where are you? Don't you even care?" I was too anxious to go inside, too anxious to stay put. I paced up and down the steps of the building where I was staying, and I thought, Lucian could find me here. I'm only 1 degree removed from D.I. Green. He knows I work with her. I am an idiot for staying in this flat. I thought, there are places in America where no one could find me. I thought I could change my name and move out to Oklahoma. I would be safe, I thought. Safe. Safe, safe, safe. Moriarty had paid for 2 other plane tickets. I didn't have their names on the reservation. I hadn't known how to look it up. Philippa, I thought, and perhaps another henchman, another tattooed man to hunt us through the woods like deer. Why was I feeling all of this now? Was this what happened when you carved a door into the dam, that the water eventually blew it out, came rushing through? I wasn't safe. I had never wanted so badly to be safe. I had been chasing this man for so long, and now I would give anything to be in Switzerland with my mother, accepting whatever comfort my mother was capable of giving me. But if Lucian Moriarty didn't already know where I was staying, he would if I kept on causing a scene, in daylight, dressed as myself. I was making a spectacle of myself. Already an elderly woman had stopped to ask if I needed help. Did I need to make a call? I was fine, I assured her. I was just locked out and very badly had to pee. That excuse had a 98% success rate. She nodded, then walked away. I ran through Latin declensions in my head. I started listing the bones in my legs out loud, first alphabetically and then by size. I named the stars I knew by heart. A long, unrolling scroll of data in my head. Things I knew. Things that could be put into tables and lists and studied. Things that you learned that wouldn't change, no matter how the world did. I'm changing, I thought suddenly. I had wanted to, and so I was. Last year, I would never have behaved this way if I knew Lucien Moriarty was coming. What would I have done? Smoked for a long time. Considered Watson's capabilities. Thought about what I could stand to lose. I would have gambled big on a plan to snare Lucien and leave him helpless, using my brother's money and my father's connections. And after I saw him hung, I would have washed my hands of it completely. Put him in a black box, sunk him to the bottom of the sea. That was, of course, before August's death. Again, I was thinking about it. I never let myself think about it, and now, in the last 24 hours, I had to create a litany to keep myself in the present. What safeguards did I have left? I went back through my list. The quadratic equation. Fermi's paradox. Numbers and letters in concert, balanced. I thought about the day that August Moriarty knocked on my bedroom door, the day after my 14th birthday. I was in bed quite a lot after that stint at rehab. I'd gone back to my old supplier the moment I'd returned home, and then tried, unsuccessfully, to cut myself off. It had been a week. The symptoms were the same as they always were. There was a strange comfort to the nausea, the burning, the accompanying black mood. I knew them like they were old friends. Charlotte, he'd said, then knocked again.
Do you mind coming out, so I can meet you? I realize this is rather awkward.
I was still in bed. I was spending rather a lot of time in bed. Yes, I told him, and rolled my face back over into the pillow.
Yes, you do mind, or yes, this is awkward?
What was the word I wanted? I had read it in a book once, but I was blurry. The walls were raw. The walls of my head. I was having some trouble with it, the thinking.
I'm indisposed. Come back tomorrow.
A sound, like him putting a palm against the door. Then the door opening.
Oh, he said. Do you want some light?
And before I could protest, he'd gone into a flurry of motion, flicked on the lights, pulled open the blinds, retrieved my blanket from the floor, and folded it up at the foot of my bed. I heard all of this rather than saw it. I still had my face pressed to the pillow.
Charlotte?
I finally turned to look at him. He had a lock of blonde hair that curled up and away from his face like a decoration. Later, I would find it beautiful.
Your parents aren't here?
No, I said, then realized that might be a lie. Maybe. I'm not sure.
And you're ill?
That was a simple explanation. I took it. Yes. I watched him come to a decision.
If this is to be our first day, then we'll have a first day.
He fidgeted for a moment, looking at me. I did look back, though I'm sure I had all the effect and charm of a wall clock, and then looking around the room. Idly, with a finger, he scanned the bookcase that housed my library.
When I was ill, I used to like to have someone read to me,
August said quietly. Then,
do you like to be read to?
I don't know, I said, because I didn't. What did he have in mind? A calculus textbook? That seemed difficult. I can try to find...
Ah!
His finger had stopped.
How about this?
He asked, pulling a volume from the shelf. I can't see it, so I can't offer an opinion.
Hush,
he said, but kindly.
I'll just sit in this chair then, and we can begin here. You'll find it illuminating, I'm sure.
I'm sure, I said. He was hiding the cover with his hands. He thumbed it open, flipped to the back of the book.
It is with a heavy heart, he said, that I take up my pen to write these last words in which I shall ever record the singular gifts by which my friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, was distinguished.
And that was how I came to know August Moriarty. his slow, steady voice reading the memoirs of Sherlock Holmes to me as though I was his younger sister, or his beloved, or both. He wouldn't ever do that again. I realized then I was crying. That was how Leander found me, on the bottom step of a brownstone, my arms around my knees. "You came," I said, and then I cried a bit harder. He got me upstairs and into the apartment, sat me on the overstuffed sofa, put a blanket around my shoulders, and left me there to cry. Moments later, I heard him running water for a bath. "Up," he said, "come along," and led me to it by the hand, as though I were a child. "It has bubbles," I said numbly. "Pink bubbles." They were foaming up out of the water. They smelled like roses.
"It does," he said. "Go sit in that for a while. At least 20 minutes. Understood?"
I nodded.
"Okay, then,"
he said, and pushed me inside and shut the door. I sat in the bath as instructed. I pulled the pins out of my hair and laid them out in a row. I took off my makeup with a cloth and put my head under the water for a long, warm moment, and when I surfaced, I realized I hadn't had a bath in ages. I didn't like the waiting of it, the patience needed for the tub to fill. Leander had gone out. I heard the front door open again now, and his particular footfalls as he returned. He was exaggerating them on purpose, so I knew it was him. My breath started coming faster. Perhaps Lucien had tracked me here. Perhaps Lucien knew Leander and me both well enough to know how Leander walked and... But then he started singing. He never sang, but he was singing now, some Irish folk song about a man named Danny. It was unmistakably my uncle, sweet and resonant and sad, and I wanted to cry again. "Whatever is making me like this is wretched," I thought, "and ends now." And I got up and toweled off my hair and put myself into a robe. I realized then that I had spent the last hour in emotional turmoil and not once thought about the pills stashed away in my coat. "You have a terrible singing voice," I told Leander in the kitchen. On the kitchen island, he had laid out a paper bag of giant pastries, a pair of salads, and a well-polished, sawed-off shotgun.
"I can't be completely perfect," he said, and offered me a cronut.
We ate. It would be more honest to say that Leander bolted his food and then watched me eat. I made it through a pastry in my usual way, slow bites and sips of water and tearing the thing into pieces to give my stomach time to settle as I went.
"It's still like that for you," Leander said.
"Yes," I said. As a child, mealtimes had been difficult. I didn't like food then. I didn't now. Verbum sap. "What is that shotgun for?" He inched the salad toward me.
"One bite for one answer."
"I'm not a toddler. I don't need to be bribed."
"Really?"
He opened the lid.
"It's a salmon salad from Dean and DeLuca. And if you eat it, I'll get you oysters for dinner."
I smiled a little, despite myself. "Fine. Hand me a fork." Leander talked at length. He paced as he spoke about the past 12 months, up and down the narrow aisle between the kitchen island and the sink. What he told me about Watson I had largely already known, though I obediently ate a forkful for each fact. But he filled me in on what he'd learned from his research into Peter Morgan Vilk, after his and James Watson's interview with him in the stairwell.
"Morgan Vilk's father, the one Lucien left in the lurch during his political campaign, isn't hiding out in Europe with his mistress. Not anymore. Merrick Morgan Vilk is back in New York."
Leander gestured at my salad, and I took a bite.
"He's putting together an exploratory team for political office, though which office or why a British politician is doing so in the States, I don't know. What I do know is that he hates Lucien Moriarty, and he has a fair deal of money and influence, and you owe me at least 2 bites for that."
I took my time with them, thinking. "Do you think Merrick Morgan Vilk knows Lucien is working with his son, Peter?"
"Probably not. And Lucien has his son's passport for a reason. Peter Morgan Vilk might just think he's gotten a good deal. He gets to piss off the father he hates while making a paycheck, and all he has to do is stay in America. But Lucien has to have a plan, and I doubt it has anything to do with foreign travel. If you have someone's passport, you can steal their identity, take their money. There are even cases of people's houses being stolen.
I laughed. Then I realized he was serious. I'm sorry?
I dealt with a case last year, he said, fishing out another pastry. It's absurdly simple. The con downloads a transfer of property form, makes copies of the stolen passport and forges the signature, and signs the house over to his actual name. A woman I worked for paid her mortgage for months, not realizing she was lining someone else's pocket. I found the thief in Vancouver after a long search and persuaded him to come back to the States with me. I'm not saying this is exactly what Lucien has planned, but you can do quite a lot with someone else's identity, and I imagine that he plans to.
And he has Merrick Morgan Vilk's son involved. Merrick, who has no love for Lucien Moriarty. I thought for a moment. Do you think we should approach him directly for help? The father? Leander laughed, surprised.
Not unless you want to announce our presence with a bullhorn. I'm sure Lucien knows about Morgan Vilk's current political plans. It isn't public, but it isn't on lockdown either, and he'll have eyes on the campaign. No, I think we have to convince Morgan Vilk more indirectly.
Put that on hold for now, I said. I had an idea for this afternoon. You know about the Virtuoso School?
I do. Spent any time on their website recently.
Why would I? I've been reading New York's private school forums. Leander began to smile.
And?
Hartwell, I said. He wasn't listed on the official website, or on any of the provisional pages I could find online. The only connection of his name that I found with the Virtuoso School had been a man named M. Hartwell 43 asking a question about paid vacation leave. He was a new employee, too new to be officially listed, and already he was looking to switch jobs. But he hadn't yet.
Hartwell.
His mouth quirked up.
Good work.
As we'd been talking, I found myself warming from the inside. Perhaps it was simply the bath, or the food, or the presence of an adult I admired, but there was more than that. I had that feeling of being known, of having all my dark corners illuminated. It wasn't a new feeling. I'd had it in the past, with Leander and Watson, and once even with my mother. But it had been a very long time. I've been... I struggled with saying it. I think I've been impossibly awful to you. I won't be again. Leander nodded. His eyes were bright. Thank you for sharing what you know, and for trusting me. I know I don't deserve it. The words were coming easier now, the damn door blown open.
Darling girl,
my uncle said a bit hoarsely.
Of course you deserve it. How would you like yourself a partner?
The Virtuoso School was in the middle of Manhattan, on a surprisingly serene street in Chelsea. We weren't far from Peter Morgan Vilk's apartment, in fact, and I put my umbrella up against the rain, not out of worry for my hair or clothes, but because I wanted a shield ready against recognition if I needed one. The school itself was quiet, furnished in the spare style my mother had always liked, and yet there was a hominess to it I hadn't expected. Natural light, wooden rafters, a pair of girls holding hands running late to class. It made me nostalgic for a school life I'd never had. Somewhere in the background, a girl was playing her cello, but I didn't recognize the piece. It might have been of her own devising. We were shown to the admissions suite, where we were greeted, to our disappointment, by a girl in a smart dress who had us fill out a dossier. I thought Hartwell worked Wednesdays, I whispered to my uncle, but he shook his head imperceptibly.
Don't worry, he said at normal volume. We'll get you in. You belong here.
And the man walking into the suite laughed a bit to himself.
I admire your confidence, he said.
Leander stuck out his hand.
Walter Simpson. Michael Hartwell, he said. Why don't you come into my office and tell me a bit more about your daughter? My niece, Leander said, with his 1,000-watt smile,
and this time when he reached out to guide me into the room, my hesitation was all pretend. This is such a gorgeous place,
I said, sitting down and smoothing out my skirt. I keep hearing music. It's wonderful.
I know it's late in the year for a transfer, Leander said. Of her senior year, Miss Simpson will have already applied to colleges by now, yes? I don't know how much we can help her.
Hartwell flipped through my file again, then shut it. He gave me a sympathetic smile.
May I ask why you're looking to change schools now?
I stared down.